Well, good afternoon and welcome to this session, which is about the suffering church. For those people who listen to this recording after Celebrate is over, it might be worth mentioning that the text and the PowerPoint presentation that those of you who are in the hall today will be able to see, the PowerPoint presentation is available on my website at www.davidalton.net. So anyone who wants to follow that whilst listening to the talk is very welcome to do so. While we were travelling here to celebrate on Easter Day, 12 Christians in Iran were standing trial on Easter Sunday on the charge of apostasy, in other words, that they had converted to Christianity. On that same day, 38 people were killed in two bomb attacks at churches in northern Nigeria. In Egypt, on Easter Sunday, a teenager was jailed for 3 years for posting cartoons which were deemed to be insulting to Islam. He posted them on Facebook. In Kenya, 2 Christians were killed and 50 wounded when Muslims threw a grenade into an open-air Christian gathering near Mombasa. And in Turkey, a pastor was beaten in his church and he was threatened with death unless he recited the Islamic Confession of Faith. It's just worth mentioning those stories because they're not ancient history. They're stories from this Easter Sunday, from different parts of the world. And it reminds us that we enjoy enormous privileges and liberties and freedoms in this country. And they are gifts that are given to us to be held in trust. It's what we do with those gifts that really matters. We must become, I think, a voice for the voiceless. And if I can say nothing else today, and if I need no other thought by the time I finished, it would be that. That we can't ignore the plight of Christians who are part of the household of faith in other parts of the world, like those 12 Christians standing trial on Easter Sunday this week simply because they had become Christians as apostates, or those 38 killed in the two bomb attacks in churches in northern Nigeria. Now, when thinking of these things, I want you to think also of an ancient Chinese story about a man named Bian, and who lived around 500 years before Christ. One day, he found a large stone. It was actually an unpolished piece of precious stone jade. Bian was excited by his discovery, and he presented the unpolished piece of stone to the emperor. The emperor saw nothing except a large stone, and believing that he was being made a fool of, he gave orders for Bian's left foot to be amputated. The emperor died, and Bian tried again, sending the large stone to the next emperor. He saw only a stone, and angrily ordered Bian's right foot to be amputated. Now a third emperor ascended the throne. Bian asked to be brought to the palace. He lay there, holding the jade in his arms, for 3 days and 3 nights. The new emperor, exasperated but curious, sent one of his courtiers to investigate, and then ordered that the stone should be polished. This was when they discovered a stunning and beautiful jade concealed beneath the rough and ugly exterior. Bian is like the Christians in countries where they are grievously tortured, and one day from Nigeria to China, from Sudan to Iran, from Saudi Arabia to North Korea, like the beautiful jade which had been concealed, the beauty of the suffering church will be fully revealed. And miracles happen. Consider the plight of the church in Cuba, and consider what Pope Benedict had to say to the church there just a couple of weeks ago. Pope Benedict, speaking in Revolution Square, a country where the church had been crushed for 60 years, he referred to the day's readings, and in the presence of Fidel Castro, he said, "We must be prepared to act like the three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are all mentioned in Daniel 3, and who, to quote Benedict's words, defied the order of the king, preferring, quotes, to face death by fire rather than betray their conscience and their faith." And certainly that has been the story of the church in Cuba and in many other parts of the world, where people have followed their conscience and followed their faith. Pope Benedict, in using those words, was echoing Maximilian Kolbe, who died at Auschwitz and who said, "No one in the world can change truth." He said that when we'd found it, we had to serve truth because of what use, he said, will be the victories on the battlefield if we are defeated in our innermost personal selves. The Holy Father concluded, each human being has to seek the truth and to choose it when he or she finds it, even at the risk of embracing sacrifices. Even at the risk of embracing sacrifices. In the same month of March, as the Pope was speaking in Cuba, a new report was published which highlighted some of the sacrifices which countless men and women continue to make for their faith. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, USCIRF, released its 14th annual report, which is mandated under the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998 in the United States, to do so. It's a legal requirement which successive British governments have declined to emulate, something I personally greatly regret. USCIRF's Admirable Chairman was at Westminster a few weeks ago, and I chaired a meeting for him. You can see him in this slide with some of my colleagues, including Baroness Cox, Caroline Cox, that indomitable, extraordinary woman who has done so much for the suffering church over so long. Keep praying for Caroline as she is at this very moment visiting the beleaguered Christian people in the Nuba Mountains in South Kordofan who are being bombed on a daily basis. Now, Leonard Leo is the chairman then of USCIRF. Among his commissioners is a lady called Nina Shea, who works at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom. And I would commend to you both USCIRF's reports and the Hudson Institute's reports on religious freedom, along with reports by Aid to the Church in Need, perhaps the finest of our charities in this country working for the beleaguered church, but also groups like Jubilee Campaign, which I helped found 25 years ago, and Christian Solidarity Worldwide, all of whom do authoritative and insightful work in highlighting the plight of suffering Christians. Now, each year, the USCIRF report identifies those countries which are responsible for the worst excesses of religious persecution and intolerance, and the authors set out recommendations which are laid before the President and Congress. Last month, this committee, Leonard Leo's committee, listed 16 countries which it said have committed the most heinous and systematic violations of religious freedom and persecuted the most egregious examples of religious persecution. I visited half of the 16 countries which are listed. Those countries are Burma, China, Egypt, Eritrea, Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, North Korea, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, North Sudan, Tajikistan, Turkey, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Vietnam. Among those persecuted are Christians, Jews, Baha'is, Mandaeans, Ahmadiyyas, Rohingya Muslims, Yazidis, Alevis, Shiites and Ismaili Muslims in Saudi Arabia, African traditional believers in Sudan, Uyghur Muslims in China, Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong practitioners, Sufi Muslims, Pakistani Hindus, independent Buddhists in Vietnam, Cao Dai, and many others. They suffer persecution, discrimination, detention without trial, arrest, harassment, intimidation, torture, and imprisonment. Some even pay the ultimate price, laying down their life for their faith. One thing that's particularly striking is that although people from many religious persuasions are affected by this relentless denial of freedom, only one group features in all 16 countries. Only one group is persecuted in each and every state on the USCIRF list, and that group are Christians. Remember too that in the 20th century, more Christians died for their faith than in all the previous centuries combined, and we haven't made a very good start in the 21st century either. Yet the 20th century was also the century which, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, promulgated the 1948 United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And it's worth citing specifically Article 18. It says that everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, and that right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. It's worth remembering But that declaration came out of the horrors of the Holocaust, when 6 million Jews, but also homosexuals, gypsies, Romanies, and people like Maximilian Kolbe, dissenters who stood against Nazism, were taken to their deaths in places like Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz. Now, in many parts of the world, more than half a century later, this declaration is simply not worth the paper on which it's written. Contrast to the silence of those who cite the European Union's Human Rights Act in any number of situations, or who campaign for the rights of every other species and yet remain utterly silent in the face of the persecution, which I will suggest is near genocidal in some parts of the world. Perhaps one day a fox will arrive at the United Nations headquarters in New York or at the Great Palace of Westminster in London, brandishing a placard that says, "Save the human race," and we will see the illogicality of some of the positions which we too often take and the disproportionality of the causes we embraced while ignoring others that cry out for justice. Today, it's estimated that 70% of the world's population live in countries with restrictions on religious freedom. But do we care? Christians face restrictions, discrimination, and persecution in a wide range of countries. It's said that as many as 200 million Christians in over 60 countries face some degree of discrimination, restriction, or persecution. While religious freedom is denied, other freedoms aren't far behind. So not only people of faith, but all who cherish liberty and freedom should be involved in the battle to end religious persecution and intolerance. As Amnesty International understands, these are their words, "The right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion is a fundamental component of the universal and indivisible human rights framework that applies to all people everywhere as laid out in international law." They go further, contending that in tracing the links between religious liberties and other cherished freedoms, that restrictions on religious freedom, as well as other freedoms, including social, cultural, and linguistic freedoms, can often lead to other human rights violations, such as the imprisonment of prisoners of conscience or even death. So these things are inextricably connected. Remove religious freedoms, and these other freedoms disappear too. Yet this isn't only a blind spot which many activists have when it comes to religious persecution. The media too, frequently indifferent to the plight of the persecuted church, ignore what is happening in so many of the countries I've mentioned. I have, however, made two series of half-hour programmes entitled "The Suffering Church" for the Catholic TV network EWTN, Eternal Word Television Network. The DVDs of those programmes may be purchased from EWTN, and they make ideal material for parish home groups or study groups. And at the end of each programme, where we have a panel discussion, suggested actions are listed which each of us might take based on a combination of pressure and prayer. St. Paul specifically enjoins us to care for the household of faith. But too often we behave like the Gethsemane Christians, the ones who fell asleep in the garden when they were most needed. We need instead to take our cue from the great Christian human rights campaigner, William Wilberforce, whose actions in the public square, who said his faith wasn't merely a private concern, and who for 40 long years battled to end the inhumanity that said one person had a right to own another person as a slave merely because of the colour of their skin. We need to take our cue from Wilberforce, who said, "We can no longer plead ignorance. We must turn aside." I hope that by the end of today's discussion here at the Celebrate Conference, none of us will plead ignorance. I want to divide my remarks now into three parts. First of all, to say something of the history and of persecution and suffering. Secondly, to say something about the present situation in some of the countries of most concern. And thirdly, to give some examples of creeping intolerance in our own backyard. Let me begin then with the history of persecution and suffering. The deacon, Stephen, was the first martyr for the Christian faith. In the waves of persecution which beset the early Christians at the hands of emperors such as Nero in the first century, to the great persecution of Diocletian and Galerius, who are pictured here in this slide, at the end of the 3rd and the beginning of the 4th century, it led to what Tertullian unnervingly predicted, that the blood of martyrs would become the seed of a church, and so that came to pass. countless men and women were thrown to the lions in the Colosseum until Constantine made it legal in 313 AD for Christians to practice their faith and to emerge from the catacombs. Scholars disagree about the numbers who died, but the highest estimate suggests that as many as 100,000 people died, refusing in those ancient times to renounce their religion. But it wasn't just in the Roman Empire that Christians died. I've mentioned Iran today. Remember Iran's other name, it's Persia. In 341 AD, the Persian emperor, Shapur II, ordered the massacre of all Christians in that empire, and around 1,150 Assyrian Christians were martyred. By the 7th century and the coming of Islam, the Christians living in that part of the world would begin a life of second-class citizens, often discriminated against, frequently persecuted, a phenomenon which continues to this day. Closer to our own times and our own home, the English Reformation, which began in 1534, exposed Catholics and Protestants to a wave of persecution at each other's hands. Anti-Catholicism stemmed from the Act of Supremacy, which decreed that the king was the only supreme head on earth of the Church of England. Failure to comply was regarded as treason, and this led, in turn, to Henry VIII sending Thomas More and John Fisher to the block. Other executions followed under Queen Elizabeth, particularly a succession of young Jesuit missionaries who died at Tyburn, where today's Marble Arch is, notably, of course, Edmund Campion. Confiscation of land and houses and exorbitant punitive fines crippled and embittered many Catholics who refused to accept the state's right to both peer into their souls and to determine their religious belief. It wouldn't be until 1829 that Catholics and Jews would be emancipated. Now, it's against this background, against our own history, that we should understand the freedoms and liberties we enjoy and the price which was paid to secure them. It's also against this background that we should understand the huge historic significance in 2011 of the first state visit of a Roman pontiff to England. For over 30 years, I've been privileged to work within the Palace of Westminster, and each day I pass through Westminster Hall, where Pope Benedict addressed both houses of Parliament. Westminster Hall is at the very heart of Britain's parliamentary democracy, and it was here that former prime ministers, political and civic leaders gathered to hear Pope Benedict XVI remind us that religion still has a vital role to play within our culture. If the walls of that hall could speak, you would learn there all you need to know about the history of England. I first entered the hall in 1965 as a boy when my school, a school named for Edmund Campion, brought a group of us to join the throngs of people gathered to pay their last respects to Winston Churchill, whose body had been brought there to lay in state. The next time I walked through the hall was in 1979 as Parliament's youngest member. As we waited in 2011 for the Pope's arrival, there was a deep appreciation in that hall that history was being made, but also that it was being healed. The Pope began his address by recalling the countless men and women down the centuries who played their part in the momentous events that have taken place within these walls and have shaped the lives of many generations of Britons and others besides. In particular, he added, I recall the figure of St. Thomas More, the great English scholar and statesman who's admired by believers and non-believers alike for the integrity with which he followed his conscience, even at the cost of displeasing the sovereign, whose good servant he was, because he chose to serve God first. The dilemma, the Pope said, which faced More in those difficult times, the perennial question of the relationship between what is owed to Caesar and what is owed to God. Now, a brilliant lawyer, though he was, More believed that he had to do all that was humanly possible to avoid prosecution. And in the memorable words from Robert Bolt's brilliant 1966 script of A Man for All Seasons, and if there's anyone here who hasn't seen A Man for All Seasons, it is a DVD which is well worth buying. He shrewdly says, More shrewdly says, tell me the words when asked to swear the king's oath. He wants to assess whether they're words he can say while remaining true to his own faith. If there's any way to avoid direct confrontation and to live easily with his conscience, then More will take it. In the end, though, Thomas More reluctantly concludes that the law is offering no way out and that no room is going to be given to accommodate his conscience. In the film's exchange with his beloved daughter Meg, he explains the situation. Moore says, if he suffers to come to such a case that there is no escaping, then we may stand to our tackle as best we can. And yes, Meg, we can clamour like champions if we have the spittle for it. But if it's God's part, not our own, to bring ourselves to such a pass, our natural business lies in escaping. Pope Benedict addressed Moore's dilemma of how in modern societies men and women of conscience can be the king's good servant, but God's first. These questions, he said, take us directly to the ethical foundations of civil discourse. It's not enough, he said, to live by social consensus, opinion polls. Religious faith, he said, helps us to purify and shed light on the ethics which should underpin political decisions. These were his words. Religion, in other words, is not a problem for legislators to solve, but a vital contributor to the national conversation. That is true in the United Kingdom, but it's true all over the world too. He said, without the corrective role of religion, reason can fall prey to distortions. And when it's manipulated by ideology or applied in a partial way that fails to take full account of the dignity of the human person, then awesome consequences flow from that. 46 years after the trial of Moore, in 1541, Edmund Campion was brought to Westminster Hall to face similar charges to those which faced Thomas Moore. Having spent a year clandestinely celebrating Mass and bringing the sacraments to England's Catholics, Campion had been arrested and brought before Queen Elizabeth, who asked him if he acknowledged her as the true Queen of England. After he replied in the affirmative, she offered him wealth and preferment on the condition that he renounced his faith. His refusal led to the incarceration that he then suffered in the Tower of London. He later pointed out that the Queen's offer of a rich and comfortable life made nonsense of the charge that he was a traitor. He could hardly be both. After being tortured on the rack on September the 1st, the 18th, the 23rd and the 27th in 1581, he faced public interrogation at the Tower and subsequent torture. On November the 14th, Campion, along with his companions, Fathers Sherwin, Kirby, Cottam, Johnson, Rishton and a layman, Orton, were arraigned at the bar of Westminster Hall. Campion responded, I protest before you all, and before God and his holy angels, before heaven and earth, before the world and this bar where I stand, which is but a small resemblance of a terrible judgment of the next life, that I am not guilty of any part of the treason contained in the indictment, or of any other treason whatsoever. Campion's companion, Ralph Sherwin, added, the plain reason of our standing here is religion and not treason. The following day, a further seven Catholic priests were similarly arraigned at the bar of the hall. The trial took place on November the 20th, when his accusers described him as an agent of the Pope and the Holy See. He replied that his sole aim was to preach the gospel. In addressing the jury, he told them how dear the innocent is to God and to what price he holdeth man's blood. He reminded the audience, his accusers, who it was that had brought him before the bar in Parliament. He said, one hath confessed himself a murderer, a man called Elliot, the other, Munday, a detestable atheist, a profane heathen, a destroyer of two men already. On your consciences, would you believe them that they have betrayed both God and man, nay, save that have nothing left to swear by neither religion nor honesty? Campion was convicted and sentenced to death as a traitor. With words that still resonate in 2010, in the run-up to the address by Pope Benedict, words that were repeated during a play that was performed in London to commemorate these events, Campion said, the only thing that we now have to say is that if our religion do make us traitors, we are worthy to be condemned, but otherwise are and have been as good subjects as ever the Queen had. In condemning us, you condemn all your own ancestors, all our ancient bishops and kings, all that was once the glory of England, the island of saints, and the most devoted child of the See of Peter. Campion concluded, God lives, posterity will live. Their judgment is not so liable to corruption as that of those who are now going to sentence us to death. And as they were taken from Westminster Hall, the condemned men broke into the words of a Te Deum. Campion spent the next 11 days in prayer, and then on December the 3rd, with Fathers Sherwin and Bryant, he was taken to Tyburn, where he was hanged, drawn and quartered, aged just 41. No one has ever told Campion's courageous story better than Evelyn Waugh. His 1935 book has been republished by Sophia Institute Press under the title St. Edmund Campion, Priest and Martyr, and it includes the full text of Campion's brag. Now, the sham trials and trumped-up charges of treason levelled against Campion and Moore, the state's determination to force men to choose between their conscience and submission, and the systematic abuse of power and falsified evidence are all part of the story of Westminster Hall, but of many other places of governance all over our contemporary world too. In their final agonies, I doubt that either Campion or Moore would have foreseen a day when the successor of Peter would be respectfully welcomed in Westminster. But both would surely rejoice. As Campion hopefully wrote in the final words of his brag, "We may at last be friends in heaven when all injuries shall be forgiven." Where better, then, than for Pope Benedict to have made his explicit plea in the face of the pincer movement of intolerant radical atheism on one hand and intolerant radical Islam on the other for religious toleration in our own age? I'm not unaware that religious ideologies can themselves pose a threat to human rights. Think, for instance, of theocracy in Iran. But remember, too, that in South Africa, the Dutch Reformed Church defended the racist apartheid system. But in the civil rights struggle in the United States, some white-majority churches defended segregation. However, religion has been a compelling force in the work of many human rights activists, notably the example of William Wilberforce, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King Jr., Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and the Catholic Church in Eastern Europe, South America, South Korea, and East Timor. I'm also aware of the tendency to blame God, and certainly those who believe in him, for all our ills. But God doesn't persecute, we do. God doesn't discriminate, we do. God doesn't hate or abuse, we do. The mass murder of millions during the 20th century was not the work of religious adherents. The secular ideologies of the 20th century were all united in their hatred of religion, led by Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Kim Il-sung and the rest. And it was as a response to these horrors that 25 years ago I joined with Danny Smith to launch the Jubilee campaign in the Jubilee Room just off of Westminster Hall in Parliament. Jubilee coming from the biblical idea of a year when prisoners who are unjustly held will be set free, a time when fields will be left fallow to regain their goodness, and a time when unfair burdens of debt will be removed. Initially, Jubilee's work centred on the persecution of Christians in the former Soviet Union. So often their suffering has been overlooked. In the West, we regularly chose not to see. But a man called Michael Bordeaux, Canon Michael Bordeaux, inspirational Anglican and founder of Keston College, he started monitoring the plight of the suffering church. And he often described to me how it was politically convenient for church leaders and parliamentarians to hide behind the excuse that intervening will only make their situation worse. That was why he encouraged people like me and Danny Smith to do something about it politically. Because he said it was not the wish of many Christians, Orthodox, Protestant or Catholic. And in the wake of our very first campaign to free the 7 Siberian Christians who had been Pentecostals who were holed up in the basement of the American Embassy in Moscow, Jubilee was determined that the world should see and understand the fate of their co-religionists on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Seeing was believing. Once we'd seen the scale of suffering, an evaluation had to be made about how best to act. At first, the action consisted of individual cases being taken up with ambassadors and heads of government. This often had unexpected and wonderful results. It'd be impossible to learn the story of a persecuted believer without being affected. So it wasn't just that people were freed, it was the effect it had on many of us who were involved too, the inspiration of these great men and women. And just as many of us have been inspired by the sacrifices of Elizabethan Catholics or by the early Christian martyrs who laid down their lives for their beliefs, by raising these contemporary cases, we rapidly appreciated how much we take our own religious rights and liberties for granted. A faith that is worth dying for is a faith which is worth living for. I vividly recall one cold night in 1989 at a place called Mostyska. It was on the Soviet-Polish border. I just embarked on a Jubilee visit that would bring home the reality of the price which men and women pay for the things we take for granted. That night, I and two of my companions were ordered off the train and our belongings were searched. I had with me an ITN camera and several hundred Ukrainian prayer books, which took a little bit of explaining as I don't speak any Ukrainian. 5 hours later, after a lot of questioning, the prayer books and the camera were repacked, although a biography, which I just happened to have in my bag and was reading at the time of the late Cardinal Hume, and my copy of the Liverpool Echo were confiscated. Despite perestroika, they were neither ready for Basil Hume or the Scouse Mouse cartoon strip. Now, this was mildly irritating, but it was like nothing in comparison with what we learnt from the people we met during the visit. And you can see pictured here in this slide a man called Ivan Gell, the man with the beard standing alongside me. He was the chairman of the Committee for the Defence of the Greek Catholic Church, which is in full communion with Rome. He'd spent 17 years in prison. Behind him was a bishop, Bishop Pavlo Vasilik. He'd been incarcerated for 18 years. We met in their home that night a young priest who was acting as chaplain to the bishop. He'd been caught illegally celebrating the liturgies and had just returned from his punishment, 6 months without any protective clothing, clearing radioactive waste at Chernobyl. On our return, Jubilee organised prayer vigils, letter-writing campaigns and parliamentary action. We persuaded BBC Newsnight to broadcast our film material. In small ways, the world knew a little bit more about what was happening in the Ukraine. Now, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Jubilee's work refocused. I travelled to the military zone in southeast Turkey to see firsthand the plight of the Chaldean and Syrian Christians. I took evidence from the Coptic Christians in Egypt and from other churches, and for the past 15 years I've been privileged to serve as president of the British Coptic Association. I entered Burma illegally to see the scale of the suffering amongst the Karen people, and this was reinforced by the campaign which Jubilee launched on behalf of the jailed Christian human rights activist James Maudsley, and who is today training to be a Catholic priest. Perhaps one of Jubilee's greatest strengths has been that in its inception, we drew heavily on both the evangelical and Catholic traditions. Pretty well all Christian traditions have been represented in Jubilee's work. Among those we have campaigned for and amongst those that we've campaigned on behalf of come from all backgrounds. As the recently published USCIRF report has so vividly illustrated, the situation today is in many respects even worse than when Jubilee was founded 25 years ago. So, in the second part of my remarks, let me talk about the present situation in some of the countries of most concern, and let me give three specific examples, one from Pakistan, the other, a second, from the Middle East, and the third from North Korea. The first story from Pakistan concerns a remarkable Catholic man, Clement Shahbaz Bharti, who on March the 2nd, 2011, aged 42, was brutally murdered. Bharti was Pakistan's federal minister for minorities. His assassination not only robbed Pakistan's National Assembly of a dedicated, honest and able politician, but his death also threw into sharp relief the plight of Pakistan's minorities, those whose fearless champion he had become. Little over a year since his killing, and after the detention in Dubai of a possible suspect involved in the murder, it's worth reflecting on the life of this singularly virtuous man while considering the continuing suffering of the people on whose behalf he sacrificed his life, and maybe ask yourself, what can I do about this? Bharti was one of five children. He was born in 1968 in Lahore to Catholic parents. They originated from a village near Faisalabad. His father, Jacob, after army service, became a teacher and then chairman of the board of the churches in Kushpur. The family were observant Catholics whose faith was central to their identity and their lives. Unsurprisingly, as he was growing up, Bharti became acutely aware of what it was like to stand out as being different. In a population of over 172 million people, only about 1.5%, that's 3 million, is Christian. Half of those are Catholic and half Protestant. In part, the Catholic Church has its roots in the Irish presence within the British Army during colonial rule, and the significant Goan community, which the British established in Karachi. There are other minorities. In 2011, the Pakistan Hindu Council put the number of Hindus at around 7 million people. Pakistan's cruelly treated Ahmadiyya community is 4 million strong. There are also small numbers of Sikhs, Buddhists, Baha'is and Zoroastrians, all of whom have faced relentless violence and profound discrimination. Along with those Muslims caught up in the sectarian violence between Sunni and Shia, the minorities have suffered grievously. Terrorism and instability have led to over 35,000 deaths since 2003 and 2,500 fatalities in one recent six-month period alone. In 1947, at the time of partition, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the father of the state of Pakistan, gave a speech to the New Delhi Press Club, setting out the basis on which the new state was to be founded. In it, he forcefully defended the right of minorities to be protected and to have their beliefs respected. This is what Jinnah said. Minorities, to whichever community they may belong, will be safeguarded. Their religion, faith, or belief will be secure. There will be no interference of any kind with their freedom of worship. They will have their protection with regard to their religion, faith, their life, and their culture. They'll be, in all respects, the citizens of Pakistan without any distinction of caste or creed. Now, these words became a forgotten aspiration when in 1956 Pakistan became an Islamic republic, although even then the constitution guaranteed equal citizenship to all its citizens and guaranteed freedom of religion. Notable Christians such as Mr. Justice A.R. Cornelius became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and others became celebrated members of the Pakistan Air Force and the professions. But as Bharti was growing up, a campaign of discrimination, intimidation and violence against the country's Christian minorities had begun to disfigure the ideals of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and by the 1990s, attacks had become routine. The world slowly began to wake up to the enormity of the suffering when, in 1998, Bishop John Joseph, the Catholic bishop of Faisalabad, shockingly, as a protest against the cruelty which was being perpetrated against his own flock, took his own life. Following Bishop Joseph's suicide, Shahbaz Bharti founded the All Pakistan Minorities Alliance and in 2002 was unanimously elected as its chairman. In the same year, he became a member of Benazir Bhutto's Pakistan's People's Party. And although the authorities placed him on their exit control list, his name was removed. And in 2008, he was made both a minister and, remarkably, given cabinet rank, the only Christian in Pakistan's cabinet. At the time of his appointment, Bharti singled out the country's blasphemy law as the principal instrument which had been used to vexatiously prosecute and harass minorities. Now, it's not that any of us are in favour of blasphemy, but it is used as a law to bring innocent people before the courts, and it's been used again and again and again, especially against people who refuse to accept Islam as their religion. Now, Bharti said the law should be amended, and he proposed a law to ban hate speech, changes to the school curriculum, representation for minorities in government and parliament, and 8 months before his death, a national interfaith consultation, out of which the country's religious leaders issued a declaration against terrorism. In doing all this, he knew that his outspokenness and singularity would make him a primary target for Pakistan's radical Islamists and sensed the almost inevitable consequences of his courageous words and actions. However, he said that his stand would, and I quote, send a message of hope to the people living a life of disappointment, disillusionment and despair. And he added that his life was dedicated to the oppressed, the downtrodden and the marginalised. And he said that his life was committed to the struggle for human equality, social justice, religious freedom, and the empowerment of religious minorities' communities. He also predicted that in taking this stand, it would lead to his own death. Perhaps the greatest tragedy of Bharti's murder is that his countrymen overwhelmingly share his ideals. In a survey of Pakistan opinion, 90% cited religious extremism as the greatest threat to the country. And presumably the overwhelming majority of the United Kingdom's 1.2 million British citizens of Pakistan descent must also contrast the tolerance of their adopted home and the protection which minorities receive here with the truly shocking intolerance of their homeland. That Bharti's life would be in danger became very clear in January 2011 when the governor of the Punjab, Salman Taseer, another great man, was murdered for seeking clemency for a Christian woman sentenced to death under those blasphemy laws. 1 year later, In Pakistan's climate of impunity, demonstrators gathered to shower rose petals on Salman Taseer's assassin, to shower rose petals on the man who had murdered the Muslim governor of the Punjab, Salman Taseer. 2 months after Taseer's death, Shahbaz Bharti would follow him to the grave. On leaving his Islamabad home, he was gunned down by self-described Taliban assassins. He'd accurately predicted his own death, knowing that the cause he'd embraced, Jinnah's cause, would ultimately cost him his life. His murderers scattered pamphlets describing him as, I quote, a Christian infidel. The leaflets were signed Taliban Al-Qaeda Punjab. Our Prime Minister, David Cameron, called the murder absolutely brutal and unacceptable. But Cardinal Keith O'Brien sharply contrasted the rhetoric of condemnation with the reality. Cardinal O'Brien said to increase aid to the Pakistan government when religious freedom is not upheld and those who speak up for religious freedom are gunned down is tantamount to an anti-Christian foreign policy. At the beginning of this year, Syed Avasi, the chairman of the Conservative Party, she visited Pakistan, and in the House of Lords she told me when I raised Salman Bharti's case, she said, the assassinations of Salman Taseer and Shahbaz Bharti were tragic for both Pakistan and the rest of the world. She said they were a personal tragedy for me because of my personal relationship with Shahbaz Bharti. She made a point of visiting the Catholic Archbishop of Karachi and said that the local Christian community, her words, is doing well despite its challenges. She defended British aid to Pakistan, but it too often can end up in the hands of radicals and rarely reaches the minorities. And as much as I respect Baroness Vazi, the fact is Christians are not doing well and continue to face prosecution, discrimination, forced conversion to Islam, rape and forced marriage. The denial of civil rights and the failure to protect minorities are all directly attributable to the rise of the Taliban and the failure of the civil and security forces. Shahbaz Bharti was a brave advocate of reform of the country's blasphemy law, but he was more than this. His was a sacrificial and exemplary life, and it was given for the common good. By definition, a martyr is a witness and an example to the Christian community of how to behave, and Bharti was certainly a witness for truth and for justice. He stands in a long tradition, from our own Thomas Becket to Thomas More, from Maximilian Kolbe to Archbishop Romero, to Edith Stein, men and women willing to sacrifice their lives as the price of upholding their beliefs, men and women for others. After his death, in Bharti's diocese of Faisalabad, local Catholics fasted, prayed and processed, venerating his legacy. His bishop, Archbishop Salander of Lahore, subsequently announced that the Pakistan Bishops Conference have written to Pope Benedict, asking that Bharti's name be recognised as a name to be listed among the martyrs of the faith. On the first anniversary of Bharti's death, recall the words of Pope Benedict last year. He said, I ask the Lord Jesus that the moving sacrifice of the life of the Pakistani minister, Shahbaz Bharti, may arouse in people's consciences the courage and commitment to defend the religious freedom of all men and in this way to promote their equal dignity. Who better, then, to now raise to the altars and in these disturbed and dangerous times to entrust perhaps with the cause of religious freedom for which there is no patron saint than Shahbaz Bharti? Bharti was a victim of radical Islam, and he's not alone. My second story is about the Middle East. Take the present situation in Syria, which you may have been following all of this week, and today we're at the beginning of perhaps some kind of ceasefire. We'll see. The city of Homs, where most of the horrors have been played out, is the third largest city in Syria. It's now seen almost its entire Christian population of nearly 60,000 people flee for safety, those that haven't been killed, as fighting continues in that stricken country. The number of Christians left in the city has reportedly fallen below 1,000 after the strife between the troops of President Bashar Assad and the anti-government forces. Those who remain have spoken of a growing atmosphere of fear. During the worst of the conflict, the opposition forces attacked churches and also occupied a Christian school and home for the elderly, which was then shelled by the army. Church leaders have reported that Muslim neighbours are turning on the Christians and that Muslim extremists from other countries have been coming to Homs to join the fighting. Christians have also suffered kidnapping and gruesome murders. Some Christian families, unable to pay a ransom for their relatives' release and fearing that they may be tortured, have driven to ask the kidnappers to kill their loved ones at once. Christians are seriously endangered in other parts of Syria too. Not only are they generally assumed to be pro-Assad, but also a strongly Islamic element amongst the rebels will attack them simply because they're Christians. Bombs have already exploded in the Christian quarters of Damascus and Aleppo. Pope Benedict has called on those of us who enjoy freedom of speech and belief of religious worship to speak out more clearly on behalf of Christians in the Middle East. In remarks at Castel Gandolfo, he said, "Churches in the Middle East are threatened in their very existence." As the sand slips through the glass, the situation seems to get worse and worse. Palestinian Christians now constitute just over 0.5% of the population. In Lebanon, they've declined from 75% to 32%. Jerusalem, a city which is holy for Jews, Christians and Muslims, is, as the historian Simon Sebag Montefiore eloquently puts it in his magnificent book Jerusalem, the prime place on earth for God to meet man. Yet in the same city, man seems incapable of meeting man. All over the Middle East, men of faith need to go back to their holy scriptures and consider what must be done to enable men and women to meet one another, to coexist, and to honour and respect each other's religious traditions. In particular, it's essential, as others have done, to affirm the goodness of many fine Muslims, but also to be willing to criticise those things which are being done by radicals in the name of Islam. And those range from the outright murder, such as the slaying of the Bishop of Arano in Algeria, to persecution by law, such as the existence and capricious use of apostasy and blasphemy laws to suppress and intimidate. But it also extends to the publication in schools throughout the region of books being used by the next generation, which include pernicious incitements to hate and which poison minds. Throughout the region, the case for religious freedom has been going by default. Take a country such as Iran, which, as I've told you, affirms Article 18 of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which I cited earlier. Yet in Iran over the past year, there have been 300 arrests of Christians in 48 cities. And I began my remarks by reminding you that 12 people on this Easter Sunday were on trial in Iran because they had changed their faith. We know of 20 others who remain in prison, some seeing a significant deterioration in their health. One, a 34-year-old, Youssef Nadakami, has been held in for 2 years in Rashat prison and has been sentenced to death for apostasy. And there are reports regularly coming out that he is facing imminent execution. Do pray for him. There are now hundreds of thousands of Iranians who have become Christians. Are they all to be sentenced to death? Are they all to be sentenced to death? Iran's model of intolerant theocracy, its export of hideous terror, its failure to honour Article 18, which provides for people's right to change their faith, and its increasing persecution of religious minorities. For instance, it executed a Baha'i convert quite recently. It's disfigured the life of a great nation, and its ideology has seeped like poison all over the region. In clinging to sectarianism, Iran's regime also misses a central point. Religious freedom is important in its own right, but in democratic societies, religious freedom is a major factor in good economic, political, and social outcomes. Iranian ideology underpins both the misuse of religion and the resultant demonization of Muslims the world over. Throughout the region, these same Iranian ideologues are in danger of casting a terrible shadow over the Arab Spring. As the winds of change have swept across the region, Christians have found themselves unprotected, targeted, and caught in the crossfire. It's a cruel paradox that the removal of tyrannical regimes has often removed the thin veneer of protection which was previously afforded to the Christian minorities. The same may tragically be true in Syria. Violence in that region has been at its worst, of course, in Iraq, where it was assumed that as the situation stabilised, we might see an improvement. However, the killing of Christians there has not stopped. In October, in Kirkuk, in the district of Mufana, according to Aid to the Church in Need, an armed group assassinated a 30-year-old Catholic, Bassam Isho. On October the 1st, the body of Emmanuel Polos Hanna was found at the edge of the road in Baghdad. He'd been shot dead. Christian sources in Kirkuk said, "The attacks on Christians continue and the world remains totally silent. It's as if we'd been swallowed up by the night." Not only is Iraq, Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization, it forms an essential part of the cradle of Christianity. The scriptures celebrate the great city of Nineveh, situated in Iraq, the waters of Babylon, and the Ur of the Chaldeans. Today, the cradle of the ancient churches is the scene of their asphyxiation and annihilation. Since June 2004, 71 churches in Iraq have been attacked, 42 in Baghdad, 20 in Mosul, 8 in Kirkuk, and 1 in Ramadi. In March 2008, the body of Archbishop Paulos Faraj Rahoe, pictured here, was found dumped in a shallow grave in the city. Since 2003, up to 585 Christians have been killed and there have been large-scale atrocities. In October 2010, 58 Christians were killed during evening mass at Our Lady of Perpetual Help, the Syrian Catholic Cathedral in Baghdad. Is it any wonder that Christians are fleeing in an exodus of biblical proportions? Tragically, many fled to Syria, and it's anyone's guess what their fate will now be. In 1987, according to the last census in Iraq, there were 1.4 million Christians. Today, it could be fewer than 150,000 people. Iraqi Christians have a historic right and duty to take their place alongside other citizens in the development of a pluralistic, open society, and to once again make a huge contribution to the life of the nation as they've done in the past. But that cannot occur unless the government there improves security, upholds the rule of law, roots out the perpetrators of religious hatred, curbs extremist groups, and ends the cycles of violence and sporadic killing, the bomb attacks and kidnappings, which always leave Christians fearful and at risk. In their Christmas messages last year, both the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rome Williams, and Pope Benedict reflected on the murders at Baghdad's Syrian Catholic Cathedral. At the time, the perpetrators of those murders threatened violence against Egypt's Christian communities, and we didn't have long to wait to see those threats become a reality. At the very beginning of 2011, days after those Christmas messages, a bomb attack took place outside the Al-Qadassin Church, the Church of the Two Saints in Alexandria, as worshippers were leaving a midnight service. According to official figures, at least 21 were killed, 79 were injured. The injured included 8 Muslims. The church and a nearby mosque suffered extensive damage from the blast, and other attacks have followed. Unsurprisingly, the European Union of Human Rights Organizations says that more than 100,000 Coptic Christians have left Egypt during the last 9 months alone. This quotation is from their director. "Copts are not emigrating voluntarily, they are coerced into that by threats and intimidation of hardline Salafists and the lack of protection they're getting from the Egyptian regime." The Foreign Office, in a letter to me, says, "We believe that there's now a moment of opportunity for Egypt. We support a peaceful transition to a diverse, non-discriminatory and democratic Egypt." Well, we all would like to see that too, but that moment looks as though it will pass. Little is being done to engage the authorities in Egypt to protect its Coptic community. And once again, those words won't be worth the paper that they were written on. Those Christmas bombings in Egypt point to the spread of the same radicalized Islamic attacks throughout the Middle East and North Africa. In Iraq, there have been 70 documented church bombings over the past 8 years. In Saddam, which I mentioned earlier on, the Nuba people are being pounded to the ground in South Kordofan, and it's been described by our former senior British diplomat in that part of the world, who now works for the Aegis Trust. He described it at a meeting which I attended just a month ago as the second genocide in the 21st century. I made a speech on that subject in Parliament just 2 weeks ago. It's available on my website and also available in Hansard. My colleague Lady Cox is there at this time. Remember, 2 million people died in South Sudan, which is just the area to the south of South Kordofan, during the last civil war. 200,000 to 300,000 people died in Darfur. I was the first parliamentarian to visit Darfur when the atrocities began there. 2 million people were displaced. 90% of the villages were razed to the ground. And it's happening all over again in South Kordofan, in the Blue Nile area, and in Abyei. In Nigeria, the country's Catholic bishops report that some 200 individuals, mostly Catholic worshippers, were killed in coordinated Christmas bombings in 2011. As I reminded you at the very beginning of my remarks, there were further attacks as recently as this Sunday, when 38 people were killed in two bomb attacks in northern Nigeria. Terrorists set off bombs in churches across Nigeria in recent months. It was one of the worst attacks by Boko Haram, who are the Nigerian equivalent of Al-Qaeda, and a pledge to impose their reign of terror until the country is ruled by Sharia law. The north-south conflict there is reminiscent for me of Sudan. Christian pastors have been beheaded by Boko Haram, and they openly say that their interim goal is to eradicate Christians from certain parts of the country. Boko Haram has killed 250 people this year alone, and it does draw its inspiration from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And it's carried out numerous sophisticated attacks, including multiple car bombings. My third example of acute suffering by Christians concerns North Korea. Now, I've deliberately chosen two countries where radical Islam has been the problem. This example concerns a failing Stalinist state, which has had a combination of a communist ideology and a personality cult. Pope John Paul II described the church in Korea as a community unique in the history of the church. It was founded in the late 18th century. It's unique because it alone is the only church to have been founded solely by lay people. It's a church founded without missionaries, and it's a church which continues to suffer. 200 years ago, a young Korean intellectual, Yi Pyok, read about Christianity from Chinese books circulating amongst a group of friends. And in 1777, he brought them together to make further study. They met in a Buddhist monastery, happily known as the Hermitage of Heavenly Truth. One of Yi Pyok's associates, Yi Sung-gun, travelled to China and met French missionaries. They baptized him with the name of Peter, and he returned to Korea in 1785. Within a year, a secret church was established in Seoul, now part, incidentally, of the cathedral campus, and you can visit the place where the relics and the bodies of these early martyrs are kept. The authorities in 1785 raided it and discovered a prayer group. The owners of the house, Thomas Kim and his family, were so badly injured during interrogation that he, Thomas Kim, died of injuries. He became the first of between 8 and 10,000 witnesses for the faith. In 1801 alone, more than 300 Christians were executed. Intermittently, itinerant priests arrived in the country. Most were executed. For 35 years, the fledgling church was without a single priest. Only one sacrament could be given, and thousands came forward to be baptized. In 1837, a French priest, Laurent Imbert, became the first bishop of a Korean diocese. Within weeks, 2,000 had been baptized, bringing the total number of Korean Christians to 9,000. 2 years later, the bishop was decapitated with two other priests. Hundreds of Korean Christians suffered the same brutal fate, including many members of the same family, fathers along with their sons and daughters, wives and mothers. Typical was Peter Yu. See if I can... He's pictured here in the statue in the centre. He was just aged 13 and tortured on 14 occasions. In his defiance, he even picked up shreds of his own flesh and threw them before his interrogators. He was strangled in the prison in October 1839. 150 years later, he would be canonised. So we're thinking of Peter Yu as we think of our own children who have been here at Celebrate today, celebrating in our liturgies and the innocence that they happily enjoy. In 1845, the first Korean-born priest, Andrew Kim, pictured here on the right, he was the first Korean to be ordained, and at 25 years of age, he was arrested, stripped, decapitated. And the persecution continued until 1886, with four generations of martyrs in one family alone. In a moving CTS pamphlet, Martyrs of Korea, the late Monsignor Richard Rutt, who was a priest of this Plymouth diocese, though originally he was the Anglican Bishop of Korea, returned to England, became the Anglican Bishop of Leicester, and then became a Catholic priest. A great Korean scholar, fluent in the Korean language, and wrote the CTS pamphlet, Martyrs of Korea. He tells their story, and sadly, as I say, died just within the last 12 months. Today, the persecution has returned, to Korea in the northern part of that country, initiated by Kim Il-sung, but then followed through by his successors, Kim Jong-il, and now his son, Kim Jong-un. Today in North Korea, becoming a Christian is a serious crime. Some who have escaped say that they've never seen a church or a Bible before leaving the country. Many are in camps or prisons where they are kept in horrific conditions, fed on starvation rations. Deprived of sleep, they're crammed into overcrowded cells. They're unable to even lie down straight. Meanwhile, China continues to repatriate refugees who have fled across the border. It did so again last month. When they're returned to North Korea, they face torture, interrogation, and humiliation. A wonderful woman called Barbara Demick has written a book called Nothing to Envy, and it tells the stories of many of the escapees, the refugees. It's available on Amazon. Barbara Demick, Nothing to Envy. Very, very powerful, moving stories of those who have escaped. Any woman, incidentally, who escapes to China and is repatriated, who's become pregnant, will be aborted to avoid the birth of babies contaminated by foreign influences. There are also reliable reports of infanticide, and there are reports of repatriated North Koreans being corralled and bound together with wire being passed through their wrists and even noses. Despite the continuing suffering in North Korea, there are two positive things I can say. During my last visit in 2011, and I serve as the chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on North Korea and have been there now four times, I was allowed to speak at the one Catholic church. It's called Changchung Cathedral. It was opened as a show church in Pyongyang in 1988. And since the Korean War, during which some 3 million people died, including 1,000 British servicemen, since that war, 60 years ago, the North Korean authorities have resolutely refused to allow a Catholic priest to be resident or to minister to the needs of the Catholic faithful. And of course, they have refused to normalize their relations with the Holy See, which, if they were to do so, would send an immediate signal to the world's 1 billion Catholics that North Korea wants friendly relations with Catholic people. But as you can see from this picture, a group of people do gather regularly. You can see them on the left here on a Sunday with no priests. I went to a place called Onju, which is 60 kilometers north of Pyongyang, and I was told about the rubble of a Catholic church there where believers have been meeting in the rubble for the last 60 years. I travelled on that occasion with my colleague Caroline Cox, who's pictured, and Ben Rogers from Christian Solidarity Worldwide, and we met the man who is responsible for overseeing the regulation of churches, very much along the Soviet model. He's pictured here too. His name is Jang Jae-on. He's the Communist Party official regulating religious belief. I am glad to say that since that encounter, some senior figures from the church in South Korea have been permitted to go to North Korea, and some dialogue has opened. But by denying pastoral access to the Catholic Church, the DPRK North Korea is preventing the Korean church from providing help, development, investment and support for the needy and poor. And if you visit the south of the country, you can see the extraordinary progress that's been made, and also the growth of the Catholic Church there, not least because of the wonderful example set by the late Cardinal Stephen Kim, who literally stood in front of the military dictatorship's tanks and army at the time of military dictatorship in the south. And as the protesters had taken refuge inside the Catholic cathedral in South Korea, in Seoul, he said, "You can have them, but you have to come over me first, and then over the fathers, and then over the sisters, and then you can have the protesters." It broke the military regime, and it led to democracy, which is why the Catholic Church is so respected in the south, and I suspect feared in the north. The fact is, though, that religious freedom leads to voluntary social endeavour on a huge scale. It has led in the south to hospitals, to schools, to universities being created by the church. But of course, dictatorships tend to be fearful of those institutions that it cannot control. I can also report positively on one other thing that I experienced on my last visit to North Korea. And that's a place called the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, of which I'm now a trustee. You can see in this picture Dr. James Kim down here on the left. His story is amazing. At the age of 15, he lied in order to be able to become a member of the South Korean army. He fought on the side of the South Koreans in the Korean War 60 years ago. And towards the end of the war, as he saw his compatriots dying all around him, he prayed that he might be spared, and that if he were spared one day, he would do something for peace and reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula. Well, there were 800 men in his unit, and he was one of 17 who survived. And at the end of the war, he came to Europe. And landing in Marseille without a penny in his pockets, he travelled up to Switzerland, where he met a man called Francis Schaeffer, who wrote a very influential book called Whatever Happened to the Human Race. It explores many of the issues about the sanctity of human life and the unborn child. Schaeffer suggested to James Kim that he comes to England to learn English. And he went to Bristol, went to theology school in Bristol at Clifton College, and he learnt English. He went back to South Korea, married, and with his wife Grace went to America. He made millions, sold his businesses, returned years later to Korea, and created a Christian university in South Korea. He then went to China and created Yongbyon University of Science and Technology in a Korean-speaking area of China, his second university. Having done that, now knowing how to do it, he went into North Korea. And he was initially welcomed by Kim Il-sung. And after Kim Il-sung's death, he returned under Kim Jong-il's leadership. This time he was arrested as an American spy. He was sentenced to death. He spent over 40 days in prison. He wrote his last will and testament. And he wrote a codicil in the will where he said to the Americans, because he also has American citizenship, "There are to be no retaliations as a result of anything that happens to me. I came here out of love, and if I die, it will be for that reason." And he even bequeathed his body to the North Koreans and said, "Use it for experimental purposes, because I came here to give you everything. You may as well have that too." Even the North Koreans was pretty taken aback by this behavior. And so instead of executing Dr. Kim, they expelled him. A year later, they approached him and said, "Come back. Talk to us again about what it is that you wanted to do." So Dr. Kim returned. He raised $80 million and he built a university. It's called Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. And it's built on a most extraordinary site. When Dr. Kim acquired the site, it's the only public-private institution in the whole of North Korea, he asked for a particular piece of land. What he didn't know was that that land had associations with this country, with the United Kingdom. Because in the 1880s, a young man called Robert German Thomas travelled with his wife Caroline on behalf of the Scottish Bible Society. They were from Wales, from South Wales, near Abergavenny. They travelled with 500 Bibles to the Far East. Caroline died of a fever in Beijing. Robert German Thomas went on to Pyongyang because he'd heard that there were Catholics there who didn't have Bibles. He took the Bibles to Pyongyang. Having started distributing them, he was arrested. He was arrested, and then he was executed. The executioner picked up Thomas's own Bible. 40 years later, the executioner gave his testimony, having read that Bible. He gave his testimony as his son became the first elder of the Thomas Memorial Church, which was built on the spot where his son had been executed. That church stood there until the Japanese occupation of Korea, when it was razed to the ground. Unbeknown to Dr. James Kim, the place where he built his university is the place where that church had stood and where Robert German Thomas had been executed. Today there are some young English people on the staff at PUST. The official teaching language is English. Churches in this country are supporting some of those who are teaching there. One, Professor Colin McCulloch, is a Cambridge graduate who helps run the English language faculty. This is an extraordinary sign of hope. In amongst all of the horrors and the terror and the fear, it shows that some things are possible. Dr. Kim is a man with an infectious, joyful laugh, and he says, "I don't believe in capitalism or communism. My ism is love-ism." PUST has been clearly embraced as a flagship by the country's leadership. It remains the country's first and only privately funded international institution, with a small cohort of academic staff, mainly Christians, drawn from Europe, China and North America, openly promoting a strategy for enabling Korea's citizens to engage successfully in the world economy and on a global scale. Dr. Kim says, "Tell about the eagerness and hope for the future among the young people here." See if I can bring the slide up. "And who will be among the leaders for tomorrow? If we outsiders demonstrate our own peaceful ways, it will make it easier for the people of the DPRK to reciprocate these peaceful efforts." Pust and Dr. Kim's story is a small story of hope, and full details of that, if you want to know more, appear on my website. Now, finally, I want to say something about religious liberties in the United Kingdom and in our own backyard. Let me give some examples of creeping intolerance in the United Kingdom. There's a growing apprehension, I think, in this country about the systematic erosion of religious freedom and disrespect for the rights of conscience. And although it is nothing in comparison with the historic examples I've given you and the things which are happening to brothers and sisters the world over, we are witnessing some creeping discrimination about which we should be more than well aware. Last month, the Scottish courts, for instance, told two Catholic midwives that they have no right to conscience in refusing to oversee mid- and late-term abortions. Think about this issue in the context of Thomas More and Edmund Campion saying that they were the good servants of the state, but God's first. You have to have a right to conscience. This is an attempt to corral us into a cattle pen where we're all forced to be complicit in the deliberate taking of innocent human life. But it's only the latest example amongst many. In January 2009, a poll showed that more than 4 out of 5 churchgoers, that's 84%, think that religious freedom of speech and action is at risk in the United Kingdom. A similar proportion, 82%, feel it's becoming more difficult to live as a Christian in an increasingly secular country. It was obvious from the vitriolic and fanatical language during the Pope's visit in 2011 that there are some in Britain who have a visceral hatred of Christianity. Under the nomenclature and language of equality, this intolerance has led to countless ludicrous examples of risible things which public and private bodies have done in recent years, all under the guise of equality. In 2008, 2 years after we first outlawed religious discrimination in goods and services under the pretext of causing no offence, Oxford Council dropped the title Christmas from the city centre's celebrations. And instead of Christmas, they substituted Winter Light Festival. The banning or dilution of Christian festivals has been criticised not only by Christian leaders, but also by Muslim and Jewish leaders. And I personally enjoy the celebration of Hanukkah or Diwali or the Passover this week. And I know of no rabbi or Hindu leader who feels offended by my enjoyment of Christmas or Easter. Their complaint is usually about aggressive ideological secularisation. In 2008, it was reported that a Yorkshire college had removed Christmas and Easter from its staff calendar in case they offended people. Instead, senior managers at Yorkshire Coast College in Scarborough in North Yorkshire said that the holidays would be referred to as end-of-term breaks in order to increase inclusion and diversity. Well, what next? Must we refer to the Sabbath as the day that dare not speak its name, or the parish as the collective, when we have to remove the names of saints from all the streets, towns or colleges that bear them? Before a public outcry, Perth Royal Infirmary was told to remove the communion table from its chapel after the National Health Service Trust warned that it could offend non-Christians. And earlier this year, a councillor in Biddeford, not far from where we're meeting, went all the way to the High Court to prevent prayers being said before meetings of his council. My good friend Anne Farmer, Anne has a wasting muscle disease and has 2 disabled brothers and had a brother-in-law who's a quadriplegic and has just written a new book called The 5 Wounds of Christ, which I really would commend to you, as well as her earlier big book, which is on eugenics and abortion. But Anne also has a wonderful sense of humour, and she sent me just on Saturday last, on Easter Saturday, a poem that she's written that I'm going to share with you because it concerns Bideford Council and their attempt to ban prayers. It's called The Ballad of Bideford. The modern atheist has now evolved to address all sorts of modern woes, that is, to solve all problems previously solved, and to this end we need a rational debate by those devoid of poetry, pragmatic souls whose inclination is to prose on all related matters, for it's so unfair how non-believers are excluded, and shockingly I can disclose that down in Bideford they said a prayer. It surely is high time that we devolved from Christian church a moral privilege so grandiose, and to this end a plan has been resolved to send all Christian clergy to the far pharaohs if they should dare to discompose the equality all men are known to share in the fight against intolerance wherein the throes, and somewhere down in Bideford they said a prayer. The private pranks of Christians we'll all absolve, but public reputations we will burn and we'll bulldoze. Long-held beliefs through power of the law, and is so convulsed that it will keep them on their toes. Through fear of heavy fines, and though we might foreclose our ecclesiastical property, 'tis guaranteed that few will care, except there'll be no Christians in the winter snows, for down in Bideford they said a prayer. Envoy, Prince, speaking for yourself, you would dissolve authority of church if you were not aware the loss of your own privilege this would involve, and down in Bideford they wouldn't have a prayer. I think that Anne Farmer sums it up brilliantly. We will not have a prayer if we dispense with our Christian heritage, like prayers in Parliament, which we continue to say every day in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. There's no compulsion to attend, and these prayers in Bideford have been said for centuries. Now we're told it will be illegal, and the government are having to change the law to allow them to be said. We're also told it will be illegal to wear a cross or a necklace while you're at work in case it might cause offence. Cardinal Keith O'Brien in Edinburgh on Sunday last dedicated his Sunday sermon to the importance of the cross in Christian life, and he suggested that many of us should wear crosses simply to make the point that we will not be told what we can and cannot wear. It's ironic that last week the Prime Minister, David Cameron, invited Christian leaders to Downing Street, and he told them how good it was that Christians were fighting back. Well, Christians don't, on the whole, fight back in those kind of terms. But the irony is that it's laws that his own government have promulgated and are now supporting in the case of the wearing of a cross that Christians are having to contest. It would be good if we were both on the same side. Surely in a truly tolerant and diverse society, we wouldn't have to contend with such ideological claptrap and even hatred. You don't have to be religious to recognise this country's rich inheritance. Along with many others, I was outraged to read about Nadia Owide, the British Airways employee, who was told to conceal a small silver cross, which she wore, as some of you are doing here today, around her neck. Swami Chakrabarty, the admirable director of Liberty, under the headline, "Freedom must apply to all faiths and none," said in an article in The Times, "The Christian's right to wear a cross must be defended as fiercely as any other religious liberty." Ms. Chakrabarty adds, "The Employment Appeal Tribunal found no discrimination because Christians generally do not consider wearing a cross as a religious requirement." She says, "This fundamentally misunderstands the idea of individual rights and freedoms, which don't depend on how many people agree with your conscience or speech. It also opens up secular courts to lengthy arguments as to what is a theological necessity. Making windows into men's soul is as pointlessly complex as it is dangerous." I wholeheartedly agree with Swami Chakrabarty, and particularly her assertion that here, talking about the United Kingdom, here the struggle for religious freedom has been strongly connected with the struggle for democracy itself. Now, friends, a Liberty Comres poll found that 86% of British Christians polled disagreed with British Airways' treatment of Miss Owide, and 80% agreed that her case sets a dangerous precedent. Even more encouragingly, 96% think that everyone should have freedom of thought, conscience and religion so long as they don't do harm to others. 85% said that they, regardless of your faith, the law should protect the right to wear its symbols, again, as long as they don't do harm to others. We need to realise what's at stake and that millions quietly share our apprehension that Britain is becoming a cold place for Christians. Our Judeo-Christian ideals are woven into the nation's fabric. Its laws, its charitable endeavours, its schools, its hospitals, its hospices, its art, its architecture, its culture, its spirituality. It's there in all our political traditions. After all, faith in politics gave us Wilberforce, Shaftesbury, Gladstone, Keir Hardie and many others. This makes it all the more perplexing for me to encounter an ideological intolerance that seeks to marginalise religion, and Christianity in particular, not least because the majority of people in this country, almost three quarters, still call themselves Christian. I'm not arguing that we should force the Christian faith on those who don't hold it. I'm simply arguing that evidence of the Christian faith in society, such as Bibles, prayers, and the wearing of a cross, should not in itself be classed as discrimination. We live in a society that in the recent past has been known for its religious tolerance. We should be proud of this. If instead of learning to celebrate our country's Christian story and its heritage, we try to deny it, we'll be doing nothing to create a genuinely more plural or tolerant society, and we'll probably only succeed in offending the Christian majority. It's particularly significant that leaders of minority faiths argue for the importance of preserving our country's religious heritage. The chief rabbi, probably the greatest of our spiritual leaders in Britain today, in his magnificent book, The Home We Build Together, makes the case much better and more clearly than I'm capable of. Speaking of the marginalisation of Christianity, Lord Sacks says this: "Marginalisation not only shows how deeply British elites are alienated from the national religion," he says, "this is not yet, but it comes close to self-hatred. It represents the breakdown of an identity, and nothing good can come out of it." He perceptively writes that Britain set out with a commitment to value all cultures. Then, he says, it became valuing all cultures equally, a completely different proposition. Then it became valuing all cultures except your own. That is when it becomes pathological. You cannot value all cultures but your own. Our problem, then, friends, is that with attacks on church schools, adoption agencies, as well as beliefs about everything from abortion to marriage, we're ditching who and what we were without putting anything in its place. In the public square, atheism is held out to be neutral, while Christians are told to keep their beliefs private and not to bring them into public life. They're being told to keep their Christianity at home or at church and never bring it to where they work or into public contention. And increasingly shrill voices demand the dilution and ultimately the end of our church schools. Far from being the armour of protection, laws designed to promote equality and oppose discrimination are being used to discriminate against people with religious faith and to undermine their right of legal protection. When it comes to applying equality and diversity laws, Christians seem to be the first to be punished and the last to be protected. This prejudice and intolerance must end. And let me end. I've directed my remarks today to three areas: historic persecution, contemporary persecution, and increasing erosion of religious liberty in the UK. Although the horrors outlined in the first two sections are clearly of a different order and magnitude to religious discrimination here at home, we would be deluded if we didn't see a connection. Our task must be to assert the importance in all places of rooting religious freedom in the dignity of the human person. The claim for religious freedom becomes a universal one, securing the freedom of all people of conscience, Christian or not, to embrace the religious freedom of their choice. In turn, the elevation of religious freedom brings great bounty to society in the working out of charitable endeavour and the deepening of the common good. Perhaps in the context of the challenges to which I've referred, this denotes the greatest benefit and the reason why all governments should be seized by the importance of promoting freedom of religious belief. I began by quoting Pope Benedict in Cuba's Revolution Square. Let me come to my conclusion by returning there. Pope Benedict reminded us of two things. First, that religious freedom solidifies society. He said, "Strengthening religious freedom consolidates social bonds, nourishes the hope of a better world, and creates favourable conditions of peace and harmonious development, while at the same time establishing solid foundations for securing the rights of future generations." And secondly, he says that we must be aware of intolerance and prejudice in our own lives. He says, "There are those who wrongly interpret this search for truth, leading them to irrationality and fanaticism. They close themselves up in their truth and try to impose it on others, These are like the blind scribes who, upon seeing Jesus beaten and bloody, cry out furiously, "Crucify him." Anyone who acts irrationally cannot become a disciple of Jesus. Faith and reason are necessary and complementary in the pursuit of truth. God created man with an innate vocation for truth, and he gave him reason for this purpose. Certainly, it is not irrationality, but rather the yearning for truth, which the Christian faith promotes. This yearning for truth is the antithesis of homogenization that implies a one-size-fits-all vacuous Western modernity to be imposed throughout the world. In Catholic thought, subsidiarity and universality sit happily alongside one another, but so do reason and faith, the domains of secular rationality and religious conviction. These domains are interdependent, and to be civilized, we need them both. Never forget that religion is the single most important factor in giving. In the United States, 85% of giving comes through charities inspired by their religious faith. In Europe, our great universities, schools, hospitals and modern hospices and many charitable foundations were created through Christian impulse. I end with a sentence from the historic document Dignitatis Humanae, the great declaration for religious liberty which emerged in 1965 from the Second Vatican Council and which forcefully sets out the case for religious freedom. It includes this telling admonition to lawful authorities. A society which promotes religious freedom will be enlivened and enriched. One that doesn't will decay. A society which promotes religious freedom will be enlivened and enriched. One that doesn't will decay. That is why we need to understand the plight of the suffering church and be prepared to take a stand, to be a voice for voiceless people and to act on their behalf. Thank you for listening.